Hanky Panky in the Classroom. Welcome back to our award-winning podcast, Class Act, Updates in Education Law. I'm Miriam.
I'm Lisa.
We're attorneys at Walter Haverfield. We practice school law. Every few weeks, we get together and talk about the most recent legal developments that affect school boards and administrators. Lately, we have been talking about investigations of teachers and other employees who misbehave.
So welcome to our third episode on those employee investigations. Once again, we're fortunate to have Sarah Marcus joining us, who frequently advises school boards on employee and school discipline issues. Welcome back, Sarah.
Thanks so much for having me.
So last time we started talking about the investigation and process in detail. Today, we'll talk about the actual interview itself and how to wrap up the investigation. So Sarah, can you kind of start us with some of the key rights that you need to keep in mind when you start to interview the accused in these investigations?
Absolutely. There are two sets of rights you really want to think about. The first right is the employee's Weingarten right. And for employees who are part of a union, this ensures that they have an opportunity to have a representative with them at different stages of the investigatory process. So a lot of districts will do an initial interview as part of the investigation. You need to make sure that you offer the employee the right to have union representation there with them. Likewise, with any follow-up interview prior to the potential issuance of discipline, you want to make sure that that employee at least has the right or is aware that they have the capability to have a union representative with them. Sometimes they will say they don't want to have someone there. That's fine. You want to document that, but you always want to make sure that you offer that representation be available to them during the process.
So don't necessarily worry about the legal jargon we're throwing out with the Weingarten rights, but the content of making sure you offer that option for a representative.
Is that done in writing, the offering, or is that something that you just tell the person?
Typically, it's something you can tell the person, but we also like to have it in writing, whether it's an email setting the time for the interview and the date and reminding the employee they have a right to have union representation, or a letter. Most of the time in these situations, certainly when you get to the pre-disciplinary conference, it's coming in the form of a letter.
Okay.
And you want to make sure that it's referenced. A lot of letters will just say, you know, in accord with the collective bargaining agreement, you have the right to have union representation present at this meeting, or something along those lines.
Okay.
The other rights, which don't come into play as much, but you want to be aware of as a school district, are an employee's Garrity rights. Again, this is something that's not seen often, which is a good thing because this comes into play when there is the potential that the conduct you're investigating is going to have criminal implications or could result in criminal charges.
Okay.
And what the Garrity rights allow are that you as an employer can direct the employee to answer questions and not allow them to invoke their Fifth Amendment right. They are directed to answer questions for purposes of you completing your investigation, but it ensures that the district will not turn that information or evidence over to the police as part of any follow-up criminal investigation.
So when a person invokes their Fifth Amendment right in the criminal context, they're saying, I don't want to answer lest it get me into criminal trouble.
Exactly.
And what you're saying is, if you are investigating an employee issue that could potentially lead to criminal charges, the employee might want to say, look, I'm not going to answer any of these questions. This could lead to criminal charges. But then because of these Garrity rights, you as the investigator, as the HR director, will say, no, we're not going to turn over anything over to the police.
Correct.
This is staying here. We're not going to retell anything that you told us in any criminal investigation. So you have to answer my questions.
Correct. And it will, that the potential of utilizing the Fifth Amendment right will either come from the employee or often the employee's representative or the employee's lawyer, depending on where you are in the process. They will advise the employee not to answer, at which point you can come back with a Garrity warning. When you issue a Garrity warning, you will tell the employee about this. You will also have them sign off on a written Garrity warning as well.
So basically, it's permitting the district to actually conduct its thorough investigation without the employee feeling like they can't answer your questions because it's going to get them into legal trouble.
Exactly. Now, certainly, could the police learn the same information through their investigation? Absolutely. But it's not going to be a situation where the district is turning over that information to the police. And if you have an employee, when you issue the Garrity warning, who still refuses to answer your questions.
Yeah, I was going to ask about that.
That can be a separate ground for discipline in that they are being insubordinate because they are being issued a directive from their administrator, from their superior. And if they refuse to comply with that directive, that constitutes the potential discipline for insubordination.
Okay. So generally, though, an employee interview is not like a police interrogation.
No, no, no spotlight shining on them in the dark room. Nothing. It really should be the opposite, because your goal in this interview is to get as much information as you can. So being open and allowing this to be a calm environment as much as possible. Certainly the employee is going to be nervous. They know, you know, there are allegations against them. So you want to do what you can, depending on the circumstances, to make sure it's a calm environment and it really operates more like a discussion. We talked a little bit last time about asking open-ended questions, allowing the employee to share as opposed to asking specific questions where you get yes and no answers. Could you need to have some of those questions, depending on the allegations, asking the employee directly, did you do this? Did you do that? You might, but you want to do what you can to make sure the employee is sharing as much information as possible. You know, you want to make sure you allow the interviewee to speak freely. You don't want to be talking over them. You don't want to be cutting them off.
Okay.
You're going to learn more information during the course of the interview that may lead to follow-up questions that aren't part of an outline you have prepared or anything else. You want to make sure you're paying attention and following up on the information that's being shared. You can't necessarily do that if you're interrupting the person. So let them speak freely. Don't tell them they're being irrelevant. Sometimes people go off on a tangent. You say, no, that's not relevant to what we're talking about. Let them be irrelevant. Or more often than not, even if they're kind of going off or digressing a bit, it's probably going to come back around. And again, you might learn more information than you would by interrupting them or trying to bring them back. You keep interrupting the employee, it also changes the tone of the conversation.
Okay.
And once you do that a couple times, the employee is going to say, well, I'm not going to go out of my way to share more information, and the answers will become shorter and more limited. And again, that's not what you're going for. Let them volunteer information. Again, some of it may not be relevant, but let them go. Let them share, because 9 times out of 10, you're going to get something that you didn't have before. And listen for contradictions. You know, if you hear something that's entirely different half an hour into the interview that you heard in the first 5 minutes, that's going to be important for purposes of assessing credibility, potentially talking to other witnesses later on. So you want to make sure, again, you're letting the interviewee talk, whether it's good, bad, or ugly, whatever they share, you want to let them get that out. You should do less talking than they do.
And certainly if you're listening for those as you're going through the interview, it gives you an opportunity to ask for clarifications while you're still in that session versus having to call them back later.
Exactly. And again, some of those open-ended questions where they volunteer more will move you to more pointed questions based on those responses. But again, that listening part and letting them share at the outset is really, really critical. So again, keep the situation as calm as possible. Don't have extra people in the room. You know, if you have yourself and a fellow investigator, sure, that's fine. But you don't want to have extraneous people in the room.
Intimidating. It's a little intimidating.
It's intimidating. And you also probably are going to get questions from the advocate or counsel for the employee about what is this person doing here? You know,
right.
Do they have anything to do with the investigation? They're not conducting this. Why are these extra people here? And 9 times out of 10, there's no reason. So you want to make sure you limit the number of people in the room from that intimidation aspect, but also the relevancy aspect. You know, only have the people in the room that need to be in the room.
And I think these points that you're, you know, sharing with us about how to strike the right tone, they apply not only to interviews with the actual accused employee, they also apply, I think, generally to any witnesses that you interview.
Exactly. Okay. Exactly. Because again, regardless of whether you're talking to the accused, you're talking to the alleged victim, or other individuals who just may have witnessed conduct or heard about, you know, misconduct, you want to make sure you're getting the most information possible. And so these tips are really appropriate across the board for everybody you're going to talk to.
Yeah. So, Sarah, you mentioned in that discussion about having an outline that you're following as you do these interviews. So sometimes we have administrators that work from a script. Can you kind of talk about when or when not to use a script and how to use it?
The $30,000 question, right?
Right.
I will generally suggest having at least some kind of outline. Some administrators do not like to do that, and if they are absolutely against it, we'll talk through and prep for that interview more than likely. But I think especially the more allegations you're dealing with, or the more complex the investigation, the more important it is to have something to come back to. Because as you go through the interview, as they're volunteering information, as you're going off into different areas, it's very easy to forget to come back to salient points that you want to hit on during the course of the investigation. So I am pro-outline doesn't mean you're going to be following it verbatim, doesn't mean you don't listen and potentially ask questions that weren't even contemplated by the outline. But I think, again, it's a nice reference point to come back to. So at least you're hitting on all the points that you're aware of as you walk into the room. And hopefully, 9 times out of 10, it means that you don't have to come back for that second interview because you just forgot something.
So it could just be a list of a couple bullet points of key things you need to ask about versus having really a script where it's word for word, have to ask this question, have to follow up with this question.
Yeah. And, you know, sometimes administrators will ask for that. You know, give me a blow-by-blow in terms of sentences, you know, outlines, give me specific language to use. And that's fine. But I think one of the things you want to remember, don't allow your commitment to that script to prevent you from engaging in the conversation. Because sometimes, you know, and, you know, lots of times.
Go off script.
Exactly. Kind of like we're doing. But I think a lot of times it will happen with newer administrators who haven't gone through as many investigations. Sure. And understandably so. You know, you're a little white-knuckled when you haven't done this before. You want to make sure you're doing everything you need to do. But you don't want to get so... you don't want to get so connected to that script that you're not listening. Because, again, sometimes you're starting with issue one, and during the course of an interview, you hear about things that weren't even on the table in terms of misconduct or other things you need to look into. And if all you're doing is white-knuckling with your script, you're not really listening and not following up on those other things that are really important.
Can I just ask a quick question? Are these interviews audio recorded usually or not?
Most interviews that our districts work with are not recorded, but they will take notes. And if you have a fellow investigator, one investigator will typically ask the questions and another will take notes. But to most situations, we do not have these. We do not have these recorded.
Okay, thanks. I'm sorry for the interruption. Sorry.
No, not at all.
Well, and how do you feel about interviewing more than one person at a time?
I think it depends. Again, Laura, I've managed one of these in every one of these, right? Laura's answer. Most of the time, I would say no. So the general rule on that is going to be no. Can there be exceptions to that in certain situations? There can be, but it really is the exception as opposed to the rule. Most of the time, you want to make sure you're talking to people individually so they're not feeling pressured, depending on who's sitting next to them, to share some information but not all information, or feeling constrained by somebody else in the room. Certainly a superior who, you know, may or may not want you to share certain details, or you're concerned about the implications of sharing details. So again, the general rule is no. Could there be a situation where you have more than one? There could be, but again, I would say that's the rare exception to the rule.
So do you ever have instances where you might have more than one investigator so that strategically one person can interview certain people and the other person interview other witnesses just because of what the relationships are?
You could. Yeah, I think one of the things you want to do at the front end, like we talked about of the investigation, is try to find that neutral person so you don't have to be going back and forth. In certain situations, when we've worked with outside investigators, they have had two investigators present, specifically in situations where we have had male investigators and a female witness. They will have two investigators in the room in that situation, just for their safety's sake.
But an extra comfort, I would assume.
Exactly. And again, as I said, the nice thing, too, is if you have one person interviewing or asking the questions, conducting the interview, you can have the other person really focusing on taking notes. Because sometimes when you're trying to listen, comprehend, and get everything down, it can be challenging to do that. And again, a lot of our investigations are completed just fine using one person. Mm-hmm. But sometimes the district will say for any number of reasons that having someone else in the room is a helpful.
Yeah, it's very difficult for me when I'm doing witness interviews or whatever to take notes as comprehensively as I would if I wasn't also asking the questions.
Yeah.
Well, and to be thinking ahead for your additional questions you need to add. And it's a lot of multitasking.
Well, and the other thing you want to think about with your script or outline if you use it is, to the extent it's feasible, you want to be asking the same or similar questions to witnesses that have more than likely similar knowledge. So you want to make sure that's as consistent as possible across the board.
That's a really good point.
And again, you know, some of it's going to vary just based on the nature of what the person knows or doesn't know, but you want to try to be consistent. And your outlines may change after you talk to the first person. If they share different information, your subsequent outlines may get longer, they may get shorter. You know, who knows, based on different people, but you want to try to be as consistent as possible in terms of the questions that you're asking again, in a non-biased way, in a neutral way, to different witnesses as you could proceed.
I can imagine, Sarah, that as an attorney who practices in this area, you've seen some similar challenges the districts encounter. What are some of the typical challenges the districts encounter in this area of interviewing?
I think there are some things you need to be aware of that can be problematic. And again, they're really reminders on the front end to make sure that you don't have other issues come up as you proceed. So one thing you want to make sure you're doing in the interviews is instructing witnesses not to discuss their interviews with anybody else, and remind them they also may be re-interviewed as the investigation proceeds. Because if witnesses start talking to each other, that can really color the course of the investigation. So let's say in our situation from the previous episode, if you talk to Ms. Jones, and then Ms. Jones goes and talks to the parents involved, the other staff members, and shares information before you have a chance to talk to them, that could color their, you know, their interview, the information that they share, and could obviously have the investigation go down a different line than it would otherwise.
Yeah, let me just remind our audience, if you didn't tune in to the previous Hanky Panky episodes, you should go back and listen to them now. The scenario that we had set up as an example was Mr. Smith. He is a special education teacher for students with multiple disabilities. And Ms. Jones, his paraprofessional, his assistant, comes to the HR director and shares that she's very concerned about his inappropriate comments, maybe yelling, name-calling, as well as some physical hands-on aggression that she's seen. So, Sarah, what you're cautioning districts is that Ms. Jones should be told not to go and discuss her interview with, let's say, the other paraprofessionals in the room, or, you know, the speech and language pathologist or the therapist or whoever, because then when you interview those people, their conversation with you is going to be tainted a little bit by what she said.
Yeah, and you want everybody to come with their information, not have, you know, other people's thoughts or interpretations or opinions of their interviews or their information playing into what they're going to share with you.
Okay.
I think something else that we see that can be problematic that you need to be aware of during the investigation is looking at what are the precise details of what occurred.
Mm-hmm.
What you hopefully are not finding at the end of this investigation is Mr. Jones made an improper remark to a student.
Right. You need more than that.
As opposed to on this specific date, at this specific time, during this period, with these witnesses present, Mr. Jones said XYZ to this particular student.
Shut up, you dumb kid.
Exactly. Exactly. Or engaged in this physical misconduct. You know, he threw a ball across the room. He threw a notebook at a student, you know, as opposed to, you know, he engaged in improper physical conduct or something
right.
along those lines. You want to be as precise as possible because, again, that's part of conducting a thorough investigation is getting down to the root of what occurred. And that's also going to obviously guide you in terms of what the disciplinary consequence is going to be because, you know, he made an improper remark. That's a pretty subjective statement. What
right.
that means to you and me could be entirely different as opposed to getting down to the nitty gritty and the details of what he said, who he said it to. It's also going to sometimes make the determination as to whether you need to report him to ODE for potential misconduct
right.
as well. So really being precise and as specific as possible in terms of your findings.
Well, and even if your witnesses say, I don't remember, you want to at least be able to document that you asked the questions, you asked for more specifics.
Exactly, which is, again, a reason you definitely want to be taking notes during this because, you know, you're also going to have to come back to those. You know, if you interview 10 witnesses during the course of your investigation, hopefully, again, you're doing it in a timely manner, but when you come back to get to your evaluation and reporting your findings piece of this, you need to make sure you've got all of the relevant information in front of you, which you're not going to remember interview number one as clearly as you're going to remember interview number 10.
Mm-hmm.
So you want to make sure you have things documented appropriately.
So as we go through all this investigation and we're trying to figure out what the findings are there certain ways administrators need to be reporting their findings, any specific format or anything they need to make sure that they include in the findings?
Sure. What has been the my rally cry here right throughout? When in doubt, comply with your board policy.
Do, 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 board policy.
Are you sick of hearing that yet?
No.
You're never going to forget now.
I hope not. Never, ever. You want to make sure, obviously, you're complying with your board policy first. Oftentimes, a specific policy may ask you to provide findings in a written format. So you want to have a written report of your findings. One of the most important things administrators need to remember is to be reporting the facts, not their subjective opinions on the investigation. Now, we talked about assessing credibility, and that's part of it. But at the end of the day, you want to be reporting the facts that you found, not your opinion about Ms. Jones or your subjective opinion about Mr. Smith. You know, can their credibility play into it? Yes, but you want it to be based in fact.
I don't want, in other words, when I'm writing up my investigation of Mr. Smith, to write, well, Ms. Jones, she's a drama queen. She's reported so much stuff this year. This is our 10th report.
Exactly. You don't want to be indicating, you know, oh, this is the building gossip queen. You know, this claim is just as ridiculous as the 14 others that she made before this. So.
However, if you're weighing credibility, you might want to make a factual statement in the findings as far as she has made 14 allegations and they've been investigated with no relevant findings.
Yeah, I don't even know that I would necessarily do that. What I would focus on are some of the questions that we talked about earlier, which is let's base it in fact relative to this complaint.
Okay.
Because again, she could have 14 complaints that are completely ridiculous before this. This could be the one that's legitimate,
mm-hmm.
remember? So I would say, if you're going to talk about credibility, and you may need to, especially if it's he said, she said, right? Talk about, you know, did the stories match or come close? And what credibility or, you know, how does credibility play into that? Did Ms. Jones contradict herself at some point during the interview or interviews? Because that obviously is going to go to credibility. Was she contradicted by other evidence? Did you look at emails that clearly contradicted her story? Or did she omit facts that other witnesses told you that were important?
So really try to look at the whole picture. Try not to narrow in just on one thing you have in your mind.
Exactly. And again, you know, things we talked about before, don't comment on the person's reputation. Those subjective opinions that really don't have anything to do with this and hopefully don't play unnecessarily into your investigation.
So, Sarah, so ultimately your report is going to have one of three findings, right? There's only three options at the end of the report: that the misconduct occurred or it didn't occur, or you just don't have enough evidence either way.
That's correct. You're ultimately going to make one of those decisions. And critical things to think about when you're writing your report or making this final determination, you know, document the facts that you learned and support those with physical evidence. Because again, whatever your conclusion is, keep in the back of your mind that it's probably going to be challenged by the employee or somewhere down the line. You want to be thinking about that to make sure, you know, does this pass the red face test? You know, if we found the misconduct did not occur, are we supporting that appropriately with the evidence, physical evidence, and the interviews, the other evidence we've gathered with respect to that conclusion?
Okay. And then, so after you've reached your conclusion, what are the next steps? Are you discussing this with the superintendent, board counsel, or the accused, the complainant? Who's notified?
Yep, you definitely, or you want to meet with your superintendent to report those findings. You want to meet with HR to report those findings. You may be the HR director conducting the findings, but otherwise you want to meet with your HR department. And you also may want to meet with board counsel to discuss the findings and conclusions and those implications. Again, we talked earlier about reporting potential professional misconduct to ODE.
Okay.
Do that. And then again, you want to follow board policy because that will also often dictate who you talk to in terms of the alleged victim, the alleged perpetrator, and give you parameters in terms of how you discuss those, who you tell, and how you move forward.
So I don't think we want to dive into it too much today, but should you have a finding that there was misconduct and are moving towards giving some formal discipline, are there any things to keep in mind, like the Loudermill hearing,
mm-hmm.
Our listeners should just have in the back of their mind should you go that direction?
Yep. I think that's an important additional right. We talked about the Weingarten and Garrity rights earlier.
Mm-hmm.
The Loudermill is a hearing that is afforded to an employee, and that's provided prior to board action to terminate. So if the misconduct, either through progressive discipline or the misconduct is so egregious that discipline is the ultimate recommendation that's going to be made to the board, the Loudermill hearing is a right that every employee has, whether it's articulated specifically in the collective bargaining agreement or not.
Okay.
It's a right that the employee has to allow them to share their story, to share their information or facts that they believe are relevant to making the termination decision that has to be afforded to the employee prior to the board taking action. And typically the superintendent will conduct that, but it is a hearing that you are required to have prior to the board taking action to terminate.
So do you have any last words of wisdom or practical takeaways for our listeners today?
I think a really important thing to remember is to try to be as proactive as possible. You don't want to be in a situation where you're not prepared or not ready to address these situations, but trying to cut these off at the pass or proactively remediate situations is a good thing to try to remember. So conduct training for employees and review mandated reporting requirements under Ohio law and board policy. Make sure employees know when they need to be reporting and let them know the parameters for what's going to happen in terms of an investigation and what it's going to look like. I think sometimes when we talk to employees during investigations, when something hasn't been reported immediately, it's because they either don't know what's going to happen when they report or they're scared about what could happen when they report. And, you know, knowledge is at least half the battle. So making sure employees have that knowledge and are aware they can report and when they actually have to report situations of misconduct.
So you want to encourage them to report.
Absolutely. Mm. You know, and make sure they understand about the internal process for making a complaint. You know, all districts have those incident report forms. Mm-hmm. You know, sometimes they're used a lot more than others. But again, you don't want an employee to come in and say, oh, I didn't even know we had that. Right. Oh, we have a reporting form. We have that incident report form. You don't want to be that district.
Right. You're going to be better off doing an investigation to look into things than being the district that missed an allegation.
Exactly. And again, some of that is being proactive and making sure not only the administrators know about this, but the employees, because they're the ones that are going to see a lot more misconduct and a lot more issues than you are.
Sure.
You know, they're the ones on the ground every day doing the work with students, with fellow staff members. I think also informing employees about the board's expectations for reporting. You know, in tandem with this, you know, there are certain situations where they're required to report based on law. But that, again, going back to the atmosphere we discussed, we want this to be a safe, comfortable, healthy learning atmosphere.
Sure.
If you see something that's problematic and raises a yellow flag, not a red flag, a yellow flag, report it. Best case scenario, we look into it and there's no problem. You know, I would much rather have that situation than letting something go, ignoring, turning the other cheek and having a situation escalate to a much more problematic point.
It has been so nice to have you here, Sarah.
Yeah, thank you for all these great pointers.
This wraps up our series on employee discipline, and our next podcast episode will be exciting and new. You can listen to us on iTunes, Stitcher, and please give us some good ratings and feedback. Please email us. Our emails are in the show notes. Please let us know if you have any ideas for other topics that you'd like to hear about. Have a great day.
The content of this podcast is provided for general information purposes only. The podcast is not legal advice, does not create an attorney-client relationship, and should not be relied upon in making legal decisions. Actions on legal matters should be taken only upon advice of legal counsel. Walter Haverfield does not guarantee the accuracy of information contained in this podcast.